Good morning. Welcome into In Focus on News Radio KMAN. Tonight, or this morning's program, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. This morning, we've got a couple different guests here. We'll have Jim Jeanette on a little bit later on from Manhattan Area Technical College. He's the president of the college, but we're going to start first with Ascension Via Christi, their regular segment here each month, and Bob Koppel, the hospital president, joins us here this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Brandon.
Pleasure to talk to you again, and you know, I wish the story was changing just a little bit, but we continue to see COVID dominating the news headlines. We've seen cases kind of hold steady here over the last couple weeks, although hospitalizations been kind of a different story, hasn't it?
Well, you know, as we've seen in the past, the pattern is you start to see just more positives in the community, and then you start to see that gravitate to more hospitalizations. So we're certainly there. You know, I think everybody's always wondering. So this morning we started the day with 9 COVID positive inpatients, 4 of those on our medical unit, 1 of them on our OB unit, that's a pregnant mom, and 4 in the ICU. All 4 of those patients are on ventilators. And we actually have 2 other community members who are non-COVID patients who are also on ventilators. So actually 6 patients on ventilators today in Manhattan. And that is, obviously that's a stretch to resources and ability to make sure we're getting everything that everybody needs, but we're managing that. Our overall census has actually been fairly high for the last several weeks. Kansas hospitals, so we track a lot of data, of course, across the state. Our 7-day average of new admissions for COVID patients last week was 65 a day, and this Wednesday was up to 87 a day. So to put that in perspective, most COVID patients, if they do not go to the ICU, are with us 5, 6, 7 days. So we're now dedicating about 500 hospital beds a day across the state to just to COVID patients. If you're in the ICU, that length of stay is typically double or triple that. So we've got, again, number of patients obviously in the ICU across the state. So we're actually, as a state, we're probably committing 600-700 beds to COVID patients at this point. That's a lot in a state our size. So transfer of patients has been very difficult, and it's just because there's no place to transfer them to. And the risks were really there, and I guess I always feel like I have to advocate for all of the non-COVID patients. You know, they need care too. And when we're using all of our resources in one direction, it's difficult to then have something for those who have a stroke, have a cardiac event, those sorts of things. And that has definitely been difficult. We are actually receiving requests for transfers into Manhattan. I think so far yesterday, that was the furthest one this week, and it was from a town in Texas. A hospital in Texas was actually called to see if they could get a patient here. Hmm. So this is, the state actually has a thing called mission control. And so every hospital is locked into that. And so that's how we're helping find places for beds. And they had actually reached out to Mission Control and had been referred to us as a possible transfer location for Texas. So that gives you an idea of the status kind of, I think, regionally as well. We continue with our visitation limitations. We do have plans in place if we need to limit services. We have not had to activate those plans, but that is certainly a requirement. And I think we've been pretty public. We do have a vaccine requirement for our associates by November 12th.
All right. Now, when you say hospital beds space, what's the capacity here in the state of Kansas? I don't know if I know that answer.
There's like 3 answers to that question. The first one is everybody always says, well, what's everybody licensed for? I personally think that's a worthless number. So, for example, the hospital here in Manhattan is licensed for 150 beds. That goes back to when the hospital license was first granted and you had semi-private rooms or even 3 people in a room, but we don't do that anymore. So like on a given day now, our capacity is probably be somewhere between 50 and 60 patients. And even in the licensed bed, that is also includes your count of bassinets for babies. So our license includes, I think, 22 bassinet beds. Well, you're not going to put an adult, obviously, in a bassinet. So, I think the licensed bed is kind of worthless. Then you look at what people staff and what they can currently staff that day. And that's the 2 that I think are most important. That's where we've run aground pretty much across the state for the last 4 weeks. people don't either have staff or the staff they have are all committed. It's different every day. So for example, you go back 2 weeks ago, we did not have six ICU patients on ventilators. We have that today. So that is a very different staffing need, because it's not just the ICU nurses, but now we need additional respiratory therapy hours, we need additional pharmacy hours, we need people to, you know, all these other people that come in to take care of a patient. It's that acuity or how sick people are is a huge, huge driver. You know, on the flip side, we've had a number of moms now in the last month who've come in positive. That's a different now ask of our OB staff, because this is a high risk issue when somebody is pregnant with COVID. And so that's a different challenge for the nursery staff. That's a different challenge for the folks who are doing the deliveries and even providing the aftercare. And again, you're going to now need additional resources from all these other departments because of that. And so that's why it's hard to say, you know, like, oh, our capacity is X. It really does matter on who you're caring for. And that percentage, like in the ICU world, the percentage of patients who are on ventilators, that's just another factor into that equation. You know, we also see pretty good activity through our ED with COVID patients too. And that's ranged in the last probably 10 days, anywhere from one or two people that are coming in and that have been tested and are positive up to 9 or 10. And so it's just, again, there's a litany of precautions, more stuff, more people. And so that's why it really does kind of matter by the hour, by the day. We actually look at everything now by the shift. We have meetings with our clinical leaders at least twice a day. I talk to our house supervisor every morning, sometime around between 6:30 and 7:30 a.m. That's 7 days a week we do that. It's really just trying to keep on top of everything to make sure that we're doing the best we can to take care of people.
Well, I know early on in the pandemic, we were having more older folks coming in as the patients, but I know that it's kind of shifted a little bit.
Yeah, well, so we're definitely caring for now a much younger population. I haven't looked this morning, but yesterday, the youngest person or the oldest person in our ICU was 61. The youngest person, I believe, on a ventilator was 29. And so we are definitely seeing lots more 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. The predominance of the people we're seeing are those who are unvaccinated. And we got to remember, the unvaccinated in Riley County is about 55 to 60% of the population. So it's actually the majority of the population is unvaccinated. Risk factors that we're definitely seeing are those who are obese or overweight, folks with diabetes. The U.S. population, again, about 50% of the U.S. population is considered obese. So you have this, you start to have these huge, and you know, some of this is overlapping, but you start to have this huge group of people who are actually really at risk. Age is certainly still a factor. And that's just, you know, as people get older, you kind of just accrue all of these other health issues. And so it's just harder, you know, if you're 91 years old or 95 years old, you know, you kind of layer COVID on top of that, that can lead to, you know, real challenge for those individuals. And then still the immunocompromised, those who have cancer, transplant patients. But, you know, there's all kinds of rheumatologic things that people have that have compromised their immunity. And so, again, that's actually a pretty good chunk of our population, too. If you sit down and talk with people in a room about how many have some sort of immunocompromising health condition, I think it would surprise a lot of people. You know, we can kind of, people can generalize or whatever they want to, but we really have a big population you got to keep your eye on. And that's why we encourage people to get vaccinated. That's the easiest, quickest, cheapest thing that any of us can do to get some protection.
Well, we're seeing, you know, more, the vaccine's opening more up a little bit. I know pregnant women can now get vaccinated. That was a key demographic to be added. Don't know yet when we're going to see those vaccines open up for kids under 12. I imagine probably later this fall, maybe closer to the new year.
Yeah, so I think that's the projection. You know, there was actually a thing came out yesterday about booster doses for the immunocompromised from the FDA. I think that's an important step. We're anticipating that the emergency use authorization will actually move to full approval for Pfizer, perhaps within a few weeks. I don't think that Moderna vaccine is going to be that far behind that in the process. And I think, you know, there is a question about booster doses. I would say that's probably going to happen. It's just a question of when. And actually, what does that look like? Because the doses could, in some of the early clinical trials, lower doses in the booster dose has actually been really effective. So there may be some titrating of some of these things too. But certainly, you know, from patients, I actually am pretty concerned about our kids in the community that are under 12 because they can't be vaccinated at this point. They're definitely an at-risk population from COVID. Luckily, it's a small percentage of kids who have really, really adverse experiences with COVID. But no one wants their kid to be that statistic. And no one wants their kid to need hospitalization. In a state that is predominantly rural, like Kansas, we do not have a lot of pediatric subspecialist and pediatric ICU beds even available. I mean, they don't exist here. And it's because we have a population in our state of less than 3 million. And so that's just a real question, I think. And again, I always had to kind of pull back and say that I live and work in this environment, so I probably know and see things that other people don't. But that, to me, is certainly a key issue. You know, the importance of for parents and our, you know, in this case, school, district leaders, to really think about the importance of hand hygiene. You know, I know it's controversial, but masking has been a very effective way to protect kids. It's very inexpensive, and quite honestly, it's easier than so many other things. So we'd certainly encourage people to be looking at those activities as a way to protect our kids. And if, you know, the reality is if we don't have some mitigation steps, we're at risk for losing another school year and going remote. My daughter teaches high school. This is our third year teaching. She's yet to have a normal year as a teacher. Mm-hmm. She does not want to go back and be doing hybrid and remote again. I mean, as a young teacher, that is not her desire. She will do that because she wants to protect her kids. But, you know, just really encourage people to be thinking about the easy mitigation things we can do to help protect the kids, because they're definitely at risk.
Yeah, no kidding. And we're talking with Bob Koppel, Ascension Via Christi president and CEO. I'm going to take a break. We'll talk a little bit more here in the next segment. Stay tuned, and Focus continues after this on KMAN.